This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.
The U.S. threatens to withhold more weapons for Israel. Plus, why Beijing wants people to cash in their old cars and rickety home appliances.
You could have chosen a set of policies that would have put more money in people's pockets. It's really a bailout, if you like, for the supply side of the economy and less a real effort to boost consumption.
And Uber delivers a surprise loss despite rising revenue. It's Thursday, May 9th. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. The U.S. is prepared to withhold more weapons for Israel, including artillery shells, if it chooses to mount a major ground operation in Rafah. Speaking on CNN, President Biden said the U.S. wasn't walking away from Israel's security and would keep providing defensive systems to fend off missile attacks, but that it couldn't support an Israeli push into Gaza's population centers. Earlier this week, the U.S. halted a shipment of bombs to Israel in the clearest rebuke yet of its war in Gaza. That decision has attracted criticism from top Republicans in Congress, as well as from some former Israeli officials who say it was unwarranted since Israel has thus far refrained from large-scale ground operations in Rafah. Well, staying in Washington, the House voted overwhelmingly last night to block an effort by Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene to oust Speaker Mike Johnson, whom she accused of betraying his party by relying on Democratic votes to pass legislation. While Democrats did help to stave off Greene's effort, her bid to oust Johnson fared even worse among members of her own party, attracting just 11 Republican votes. Her campaign was also opposed by former President Donald Trump. After the vote, Johnson said he hoped the House could move on from intra-party fighting.
Hopefully, this is the end of the personality politics and the frivolous character assassination that has defined the 118th Congress.
And China's exports swung back to growth in April, reversing a 7.5% drop in March and highlighting how exports continue to be a key driver for China's economy as it struggles to revive domestic demand. Well, another way to boost economic growth and consumer spending is also now being proposed by China's leaders, who are resurrecting a cash-for-clunkers policy where households are being encouraged to swap out rickety home appliances and older vehicles. Although most economists believe this will lift the economy in the short term, Asia Economics reporter Jason Douglas told us why many remain skeptical about the lasting effects.
If China is really going to pick up pace and grow sustainably in the next decade or so, it really has to boost the consumption share of its economy. And Chinese leaders have shown precisely zero interest in really doing that in any kind of serious way. So you could have chosen a set of policies that would have put more money in people's pockets, that would have strengthened the social safety net so people wouldn't have to save as much. Instead, what we're getting is a bit of a sop to Chinese factories, which have all this stuff that they've made and can't find anyone to buy it.
The tectonic plates of monetary policy are beginning to pull apart. Yesterday, Sweden's central bank cut its key interest rate for the first time in more than 8 years, and in so doing became just the second central bank in a wealthy advanced economy after Switzerland's to begin its easing cycle following the post-pandemic inflation surge. It's also a reversal of the pattern largely seen this century of Europe following the U.S. in lowering borrowing costs. Paul Hannon is the economics editor for Dow Jones Newswires here in London. Paul, we don't often talk about Sweden's Riksbank here on the pod, but in Sweden's rationale for cutting rates, I wonder if we can see some broader themes at work.
I think you're right there. What they're seeing is that inflation is cooling, getting back to its target. It was just above that target in March at 2.2%. And what they're also seeing is that the economy is very weak. Sweden hasn't seen growth for over a year now. The common problem that they confront is this surge in energy and food bills following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. This is something that hit Europe much harder than it did the US. So you've seen household budgets being sort of eviscerated by this surge in basic costs and spending on other goods and services falling. And that's one of the things that's driving weakness in Sweden and across Europe as a whole. And of course, that means that the European response is quite likely to be similar to the Swedish response in terms of interest rates.
Paul, in terms of other responses, we're hearing from the Bank of England today, and the ECB's meeting next month is hotly anticipated as well. What are the next steps we're expecting there?
People don't expect the Bank of England to cut now. What they do expect is to see a clearer signal that rate cuts are coming in the months ahead. I think investors are expecting a first move in August, but it could be June. The view now is increasingly that it will be sometime during the summer. With the ECB, it's a little bit clearer. They have pretty much told us that they're going to cut their key interest rate in June. The big question there is how quickly they would follow up with subsequent rate cuts.
All right, so next month, shaping up to be a key one, it seems. Regardless, though, Paul, of exactly when we see the Bank of England or the ECB following Sweden, following Switzerland with their own rate cuts, it sounds like they are likely to beat the Fed in that. What effect is that likely to have?
I mean, it's an unusual situation, and in those kinds of situations, you know, unpredictable things can happen. But what seems likely to happen is that if you're planning a vacation to Europe this summer, your dollar is going to go a lot further than it would have a year ago. Otherwise, you know, big picture, probably a boost to European exports. I mean, international tourism is an export, but also to the things that they make, but also a kind of rise in the prices of things that they import, including energy, specifically US LNG.
Paul, maybe some Americans might want to react to that, book some trips to Europe. In terms of the Fed, though, and its calculus, any reason to think policymakers in Washington would be reassessing their monetary policy decisions based on the fact Europe could be moving first?
I don't think so. The Fed's policy is driven largely, almost exclusively, usually, by what's happening inside the US economy. I mean, the only exceptions are cases in which tight Fed policy threatens financial crises elsewhere, which is or has been a problem in the past with some developing economies. And in that case, they would take that spillover into account, although it's not usually a decisive factor in their deliberations. It's not a game changer, typically, unless something really bad happens.
Paul Hannon is the economics editor for Dow Jones Newswires in London. Paul, thank you so much, as always, for stopping by.
Thanks very much, Luke.
Coming up, Uber reports a surprise loss, and Disney and Warner Brothers bundle their streaming services in a competitive market. Those stories and more after the break.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Chipmaker Intel has lowered its sales outlook as it faces new restrictions on exports to China. That's after the Commerce Department yesterday revoked some licenses for exports to Chinese telecom company Huawei, a move that prompted Intel to disclose it expected weaker Q2 revenue, even as it reaffirmed its full-year guidance. Intel shares dipped on the news. The revocation follows Huawei's launch last month of new AI-capable laptops containing Intel chips, leading to fresh calls from some U.S. lawmakers to withdraw the export licenses. Uber is back in the red after posting more than $650 million in first quarter losses, a surprise for analysts who had expected a nearly $500 million profit. Uber attributed the results to legal settlements as well as equity investments that it said would continue to affect its bottom line. The loss comes after Uber in February notched its first annual profit since its IPO and announced its first share buyback. Well, speaking of share repurchases, new data suggests that S&P 500 companies are indeed on something of a spending spree, a trend that Katie Barnato, a Journal Markets editor, told us is giving a resurgent stock market an extra boost.
According to Birini Associates, S&P 500 companies that have reported results have bought back over $181 billion of their shares during the first quarter. And this is backed up by Bank of America Securities, who in a research note has said that the rate of purchases has been faster than usual for 9 consecutive weeks. It seems that big tech companies are leading the charge. We've seen big repurchases from Apple, Meta, Netflix, and Nvidia. And analysts are taking this increase in buybacks as a sign of rising confidence among executives. That's despite ongoing fears that the economy could weaken or that interest rates will stay higher for longer than hoped.
And Disney and Warner Brothers Discovery are teaming up to bundle their streaming services in a bid to compete in a crowded streaming marketplace. A new package will include ad-free and ad-supported versions of Disney+, Hulu, and Warner's Max service, and will be available in the U.S. this summer. Pricing details weren't disclosed, but people familiar with the matter said the bundles would likely be offered at a discount. And finally, what could possibly beat firing up What's News in the morning and sipping on a cup of synthetic caffeine? I guess I shouldn't laugh, because research suggests that thanks to climate change, half of the land best suited for growing coffee won't be useful for that purpose by 2050, a possibility that's spurring the development of synthetic coffee alternatives. Journal tech columnist Christopher Mims has already started the taste testing.
I have tried two different synthetic coffees, one from Atomo, which bills itself as kind of the more high-end version, and one from Voyage Foods. Their synthetic coffee, which is made from roasted chickpeas, is serviceable. I think if I mixed it with some oat milk or almond milk or whatever, I probably wouldn't be able to tell the difference between it and a regular cup of coffee. Atomo, it's nearly indistinguishable from regular coffee. In some ways, it's a little less acidic, a little less bitter. But already, we're at the point where I would challenge most people to tell the difference between these synthetic coffees and the real thing, especially when they are in a drink like a cappuccino or a latte, which is how most people take their coffee anyway.
And that is What's News for Thursday morning. Today's show was produced by Kate Bullivant and Daniel Bach. Our supervising producer is Sandra Kilhoff, and I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. We will be back tonight with a new show. And until then, thanks for listening.
Enter a revolutionary business world where AI meets power with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro. Imagine PCs that boost productivity, creativity, and collaboration with cutting-edge AI. They're gateways to innovation, engineered with powerful AI performance, hardware-based security, and AI-powered threat detection. Plus, they're built sustainably and can be managed remotely. Transform your workflow with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro today. No product can be absolutely secure. Become an IT hero at intel.com/itheroes.